Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, what do we know about alleged Tucson killer Jared Lee Loeffner's worldview, which has been described as incoherent and non-political in various news media reports? And what of the right-wing backlash attacking anyone who even suggests that vitriolic right-wing rhetoric has gotten out of hand? We'll talk with Right Watcher Chip Berlay of the Political Research Associates. Also on Counterspin today, the national debate in the aftermath of the Tucson shootings is touching on violent rhetoric and mental health services, but some media are sending the message that gun policy isn't likely to be a front burner issue. Yes, the gun lobby is powerful, but we're also being told that the public doesn't support any additional steps to curb gun sales. But is this true? Lad Everett from the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence will join us to talk about that. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
A discussion of violent political rhetoric is, of course, long overdue. Unfortunately, in the wake of the Tucson shootings, some media reverted to a familiar template. Both sides are guilty. On NBC's Meet the Press, David Gregory rounded up two examples from Democrats and one from a Republican to denounce vitriol on both sides. The New York Times referred to, quote, simple political passion at both ends of the ideological spectrum, close quote. Also in the paper, Matt Bai found fault with Sarah Palin and a diary entry at the Daily Kos website, as if the two could be considered even remotely comparable. He would later cite threats and rhetoric against Obama and treated them as if they were similar to people who said Bush, quote, was a modern Hitler, close quote. The differences here should be obvious. Scattered examples of anti-Bush or anti-GOP rhetoric hardly compare to the outlandish conspiratorial worldview promoted by the likes of Glenn Beck, who is, after all, given a microphone and a television studio to spread that message across the country for several hours every day. Even people who understand Fox and right-wing talk radio still feel the need to make "but the left is guilty too" arguments. Appearing on CNN's Reliable Sources, Time magazine's Joe Klein denounced the crap on Fox News Channel. Then he moved on to denouncing MSNBC's Ed Schultz. What did Schultz do? Well, during a discussion of the Afghan war, he held up a sign that said, "Get out now." As Joe Klein put it, quote, "That's so stupid and it's so unworthy," close quote. That's right, a TV host expressing the viewpoint held by approximately half the public is stupid and unworthy and comparable to the routine distortions and murder fantasies peddled by Fox.
Pretending that inflammatory rhetoric comes in roughly equal measures from both sides is bad enough, but CBS Face the Nation host Bob Schieffer found an odd person to praise for his reaction to the Arizona shooting: Republican House Speaker John Boehner. Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi's recent profile of Boehner included the new speaker engaging in the very sort of overheated campaign rhetoric that he's now denouncing. Boehner had singled out Ohio Democrat Steve Driehaus for voting for the health care law, saying he may be a dead man and that he, quote, can't go home to the west side of Cincinnati, close quote, because voters would be angry with him. Perhaps Schieffer wasn't aware of this history, but another recent report suggested that some media outlets are looking to boost Boehner's profile. The January 6th Washington Post had a headline that read, "A modest Boehner takes Congress's most powerful office." The Post's point was that the new Speaker of the House tends to shun big moments and is, quote, more at home on the golf course with his rank-and-file buddies, close quote. A reception was described as mostly just folks, with the Post noting in passing that there were some D.C. lobbyists on hand. In reality, Boehner is mostly known in Washington circles for being extremely tight with corporate lobbyists. A recent Time profile called him a leading Republican ambassador to lobbyists. Many of his close friends are lobbyists. In fact, the unofficial name for his circle of political leaders and influence peddlers is Boehnerland. He is also, according to Time, a frequent flyer on corporate jets. No doubt he does it all with modesty.
Corporate media love a center-right Democrat, so much so that no matter how center-right a politician already is, media will always counsel him or her to be somehow more so. Obama's selection of conservative Democrat William Daley as his new chief of staff shouldn't have surprised anyone. Daley's political views, after all, are more or less in line with his predecessor Rahm Emanuel. How to Portray the Daily Pick as Affirming a Preferred Storyline? The Washington Post offered this confused analysis, quote, "His moderate views and Wall Street credentials make him an unexpected choice for a president who has railed against corporate irresponsibility and tried, with limited success, to appease restive liberals who think he has not been tough enough on bankers," close quote. Now, a clear-eyed view would suggest the opposite, that the choice of a right-leaning banker with deep ties to corporate America shows that Obama doesn't really rail in a serious way against corporations and has had little success appeasing restive liberals because he has not, in fact, tried to do so. Tell that to USA Today, though, which headlined its piece, "Daily Choice Puts a Moderate in Play," as if there weren't many moderates around to begin with. And over at the LA Times, "Obama chooses former Clinton staffers in a move to the center," was the headline. Readers can hardly miss the point. Obama intends to move toward the center, which means he's not there now. Likewise, the Wall Street Journal headline, "President revs up campaign to make peace with business." That tells you that Obama has been at war with corporate America no matter what reality says. The corporate press approach resembles that of Humpty Dumpty, except not only words but also actions mean just what they choose them to mean, neither more nor less.
The Washington Post headline over a story about Joe Biden's pledge that U.S. military forces would stay in Afghanistan after the supposed 2014 withdrawal deadline, quote, "if the Afghan people want it," close quote, is "Biden promises long-term aid to Afghans." Of course, if the U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan came down to what the Afghan people want, as reflected in polls that say they want the U.S. out, it might end sooner than that.
And finally, the Iraq War is mostly a media afterthought, but when it does show up again on the front pages, the results can be pretty awful. Take USA Today's January 12th front page story, which announced that, quote, "insurgents in Iraq killed more than 21,000 civilians and wounded another 68,000 people with homemade bombs over the past 5 years, according to newly released data from the Pentagon," close quote. Now, one might wonder why the Pentagon's accounting of the deaths caused by Iraqi groups would garner front page attention, or how that total might compare with other estimates of Iraqi deaths, either from insurgents or U.S. forces. After warning that these figures are imprecise for a variety of reasons, USA Today tells readers that a U.S. official, quote, said the military believes insurgents killed far more civilians than U.S. and allied forces have in Iraq, close quote. The paper added that, quote, the military is unable to quantify the claim, close quote. Now, there have been plenty of attempts to count the dead in Iraq, but USA Today takes a very narrow view, naming just two. The Iraqi Ministry of Human Rights estimated that insurgents killed 85,000 Iraqi civilians from 2004 through 2008. The paper also cites a Brookings Institution estimate of 110,000 deaths from war-related incidents. USA Today said that both of these estimates were derived from a report from the Congressional Research Service. But if you look at that report, you'll find other estimates of Iraqi deaths that are far higher. The British polling firm ORB estimates over 1 million dead. Johns Hopkins researchers came up with an estimate of 600,000 violent deaths from an earlier phase of the war. USA Today's editing suggests that they either don't trust these numbers or they don't want to share them with readers. They have no such reservations, though, about putting the Pentagon's numbers on the front page.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. What do we know about the politics of Jared Lee Loeffner, the accused shooter in the Tucson massacre? Is it entirely clear that he's simply a lone and deeply disturbed young man, delusional, not ideological, as a report typical of the coverage described him in the San Francisco Chronicle? And what about the backlash from the right against commentators who even dare to speculate about the role hateful and violent rhetoric may have played in the massacre? We're joined by Chip Berlay of the Political Research Associates, who has been writing about Tucson on the talktoaction.org website. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chip Berlay.
Thank you very much.
Well, Chip, many news accounts have described Loeffner's internet writings as incoherent, but you point out that some of what might appear incoherent to the average person to a studied right-wing watcher contains rhetoric and buzz phrases that might indicate Loeffner embraces some certain views. Tell us about that.
Well, I think a lot of us who have studied right-wing rhetoric for quite a while, when we began to read the obviously deranged postings of Mr. Loeffner, there were, in fact, certain elements that popped out, and we tended to agree with each other that they were drawn from a certain sector of the right known as the Patriot Movement, which is obsessed with worries about currency manipulation and the Federal Reserve and giant government conspiracies to essentially enslave us.
Go into some detail on that. There was one thing I was reading in one of your pieces about his talking about the second U.S. Constitution.
Well, the second United States Constitution or the second American Constitution is actually a legitimate historical reference to the major amendments that came after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And people who use that specific phrase, who are right-wing conspiracy theorists, wrap the legitimate historical analysis of those amendments into a conspiracy theory that basically said that the Constitution was overturned and superseded by an egalitarian constitution that illegitimately created a new class of citizenship. Well, if you read that carefully, what you find out is that new class of citizenship was giving citizen rights to the freed black slaves and to state that anyone born in the United States was automatically a citizen. So this has actually come up in the very racist and angry rhetoric embroiling the state of Arizona right now.
And one of the things that I must admit I thought was just pure incoherence when I was reading online on some of the YouTube postings of Loeffner of his comments about currency. But you say the terms he used also resonate with some right-wing views as well.
Yeah, I just posted up on Talk to Action a whole review of the history of right-wing conspiracy theories about money manipulation and currency and gold and silver issues. And it really tracks way back to a theory that the creation of the Federal Reserve and the creation of a national central bank was actually a plot. And the debate on the right is whether it was a plot by the Rockefellers and the secret elites or the Rothschilds and the Jew bankers.
Yes, exactly. As we tape this show on January 13th, a story has emerged that has Loeffner watching the conspiracy movie Zeitgeist. What do we know about whether or not he was a devotee of that film? And what is that film about? And what might it indicate about his worldview?
Well, there's only one claim by a friend of his who said he liked to watch Zeitgeist, but I think we can take that on its face. If you look at the movie, it's a very bizarre set of claims, but there's a very central section that's up on YouTube about the Federal Reserve conspiracy. Now, the Federal Reserve conspiracy theory from Zeitgeist is embraced by both left-wing and right-wing people. But in fact, the claims in the movie Zeitgeist are lifted from The Secret of Jekyll Island, a book by J. Edward Griffin, who is in fact someone who works with the John Birch Society and who in fact mirrors the claims of the John Birch Society about the Federal Reserve and currency manipulation. And actually, you can find articles in the New American published by the John Birch Society in the June 21st, 2010 issue and the September 27th, 2010 issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you've said several times, much of this is still speculation, and no evidence has emerged showing that Loeffner held orthodox right-wing views or was a devotee of talk radio or Fox News or Ron Paul, etc. But that said, there's currently a backlash from the right against anyone who has speculated that the upsurge in hateful, insurrectionist, and violent rhetoric and imagery might have played a role in the alleged killer's thinking. Do you think commentators like New York Times columnist Paul Krugman or Pima County Sheriff Clarence Dupnik are totally unreasonable charlatans, as George Will put it recently, for even speculating in this way?
No, to believe that, you'd have to dismiss the last 50 years of social science and the work of Hannah Arendt and Mr. Alpert, whose famous book on the nature of prejudice lays out the analysis that in a society where there is a group of people or ideas scapegoated in vilification and demonization, and basically the folks are held out to be traitors, out to destroy a society, it is completely predictable that some people will act out in aggression and violence against the targeted scapegoat. So, no, it's not irresponsible. It's wrong to say Sarah Palin's to blame for the shootings or Glenn Beck or the nature of right-wing rhetoric. But there's two issues here, one of which President Obama mentioned, and that is Republicans and Democrats have to tone down the rhetoric in Washington so they can govern together. And I agree with that. And I've been critical of people on the left who've called the Tea Party movement made up of crazy, ignorant people, because it's just not true. But there's a broader issue of a 30-year campaign of vilification, not disagreeing with liberals, leftists, and Democrats, but saying that we're traitors, that we're evil, that perhaps we're satanic agents of the end-time struggle between good and evil. And that kind of rhetoric creates a milieu in which violence is predictable. And in fact, in June 2009, I wrote Toxic to Democracy, a study that warned that in fact, and here's the quote, aggressive right-wing rhetoric, Democrats as treasonous, encourages some unstable people to act out in aggression and violence. So it is predictable.
Well, I want to draw you out a little more on demonization. In one of your pieces for Talk to Action, you write, quote, Sarah Palin, Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, Ann Coulter, Lou Dobbs, and a phalanx of right-wing demagogues have been viciously demonizing Democrats, liberals, leftists, and immigrants with false and histrionic claims for many years, close quote. You also say that while not legally culpable for the series of violent attacks that have happened over the last 2 years, a real upsurge, they do share some moral responsibility for what you call the becking of America. Can you explain that? Are you talking about the same thing you were talking about with Hannah Arendt there?
I am, and the original term becking is actually from Old English, and it means a nod of the head or a sly indication that people are supposed to get a message. And so Glenn Beck is the master of that. No, really, it is. And so we've been using among bloggers the term becking to describe the malicious and false accusations which set up a dynamic where someone somewhere will act out in aggression and violence against the named scapegoat.
Well, Harold Meyerson in a recent piece talked about how, yes, there's a problem of the actual becking of people and of parties and that sort of thing, but there's also another, which he says is perhaps a bigger problem, is the demonization of the government, is the sort of insurrectionist talk and the demonization of the Obama administration with they've stolen our country, they've stolen our government, they've hijacked things.
Well, I think that's consciously a strategic goal of libertarians and large corporate interests and people who think wealthy elites are just dandy and should run the government without the nasty bother of democracy. So I agree with Mr. Meyerson. I think that what we have is an actual gain, a financial and social status gain of people who promote the idea that government is the problem. We're the only industrialized society where that kind of claim is taken seriously. I mean, it's usually people pushing shopping carts full of rubbish and handing out tracts. And in other countries, there's a debate about how much the social safety net should be woven. But only in this country is there a very large group of people who suggest that government is the problem. If government's the problem, why'd we have a revolution that set up a government?
This also relates to the cause and effect of violent rhetoric and action, but one of the media tropes that have emerged in the aftermath of Tucson is the claim made by, among others, New York Times columnist David Brooks, that there's no evidence hateful and violent rhetoric and imagery can lead to actual harm. It seems to me these people are missing lessons of Nazi Germany, Rwanda, any number of places, as well as even the selling of the Iraq War here. I mean, there you had demonization, you had hateful rhetoric, you had violent imagery, and you had great harm.
Yes, and you had the demonization of Japanese Americans, which led to their being sent to internment camps. So, yes, I think if you want to reject the idea that there was an Armenian genocide or that there was a genocide of the Nazis against Jews and communists and homosexuals and others, that there was a Cambodian genocide, that there have been genocides in Africa, all of which have been preceded by hateful rhetoric. And this occurs on both the left and right. Hitler and Stalin are both examples of totalitarian demagoguery that vilifies a scapegoat. And we know from history what happens in societies that tolerate that. So I actually think people who dismiss the idea that this is true are really reprehensible and historically ignorant people who should really shut up.
We've been speaking with Chip Berlay of the Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can read his writing on Tucson on the talktoaction.org website. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Chip Berlay.
Thank you. And remember, democracy actually does work.
The massacre in Tucson is sparking all kinds of discussions about violent rhetoric, inflammatory speech, talk radio, and so on. But one theme in some media coverage suggests that one conversation isn't going to change the public's mind. As this story goes, the public has shifted dramatically over the past decade or so on the issue of gun control, a shift in favor of the rights of gun owners. But is this even true? Joining us now to shed some light on the public and gun policy is Ladd Everett. He's communications director for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Ladd Everett, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, on January 10th, there was this story in the Washington Post with the headline, "Opinions about gun control not likely to be swayed." The point was the public is more likely to support the rights of gun owners. This is based on one Gallup poll which asks people if they think the laws concerning the sale of guns should be made more strict, less strict, or kept as they are now. 44% say more strict, which sounds okay, I suppose, but in 1990, that number was 78%. The New York Times sent the same message based on the same poll. Public support for stricter gun control, the Times reported, has dropped significantly over the last couple of decades. Are they right or are they missing some data, do you think?
Well, I think the basic argument, I mean, you can't argue that the numbers have dropped and they have asked the same questions. I think, though, when you look at the October 2010 poll, which is when this was conducted, you have 44% of Americans saying that the law should be more strict. You only have 12% saying less strict. So I think even if you look at these numbers, you still see a very strong segment of the American population saying that we need to enact gun reforms.
Surely there's other polling than the Gallup poll, though, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, when you poll Americans on specific initiatives, you find much larger percentages of support. One poll that we mention frequently is the Frank Luntz poll from December 2009. Frank Luntz is a noted Republican pollster. Mm-hmm. He polled NRA members and non-NRA member gun owners. He found for things like closing the gun show loophole, prohibiting people on the terrorist watch list from buying guns, reporting lost and stolen guns, he found high percentages of NRA members and non-NRA gun owners supporting initiatives like that. Percentages 70% and above on all those initiatives.
These are things that the NRA champions or runs vehemently against, right?
That's correct. These are things that the NRA leadership fights against on a daily basis and claims are violations of the Second Amendment in our Constitution. So when you see, for example, 82% of NRA members saying prohibit people on the terrorist watch list from buying guns, or let's say 69% of NRA members saying close the gun show loophole, I think it sends a strong signal that not only is NRA leadership out of touch with its membership on this issue, on these issues, but certainly with average Americans. I think what the NRA has had success with, though, and I think that's why we see these Gallup numbers coming down, I think they have had a lot of success in convincing particularly conservatives and Republicans that our gun laws are far stricter than they are. You will frequently hear the NRA claiming things like, you know, there are 20,000 gun laws in the books to try to suggest that we are, you know, burdened with overwhelming regulation in that area when in reality we have the weakest gun laws of any democracy on the face of the globe. But I think that message has really resonated. We have a Republican Party these days that has become that has moved very hard to the right wing. There is a lot of anti-government sentiment in the Republican Party, and we see that, of course, with the emergence of the Tea Party following the election of Barack Obama. I think over the past 20 years, they've really been able to capitalize on that type of sentiment, and again, use guns as a kind of token of what they claim is oppression, but which in reality, again, are the weakest gun laws in the civilized world.
Now, finally, it's hard to predict how any of this is going to work out, but do you think there is some reason to be hopeful, contrary to these stories about the public being unmoved by the tragedy in Tucson? Do you think there's some reason to be hopeful that we will have a more sane discussion of gun control policy in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I do see many reasons for hope. We are getting calls left and right from people who are just absolutely outraged that the young man in this incident in Tucson was able to get guns legally, purchase these weapons legally, even though seemingly everyone knew he was deranged. And again, when we look at other polling data, another poll that we've looked at is the 2006 General Social Survey, which is a cast a very wide net. And when you see, you know, 82% of Americans supporting a renewal of the ban on assault weapons, or 80% supporting criminal background checks on all gun sales, including private sales, or even 80% supporting licensing to buy guns. These are all solutions which would help address what happened in Tucson, and we feel the public support is certainly there to move forward in Congress.
We've been speaking with Ladd Everett. He's communications director for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. You can find them on the web at csgv.org. Ladd Everett, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. If you like what you hear on Counterspin, please consider subscribing to FAIR's monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, call 1-800-847-3993. Again, that's 1-800-847-3993. Or go to FAIR.org to get more information. And while you're there, you can listen to past episodes of Counterspin or sign up for the Counterspin podcast. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.